Imagine if suddenly one day there was a brand new disease in Vermont that affected 27,000 people. At first, maybe you ignore it because no one you know has it, or not that you know of. It's not infectious or dangerous or anything. Still, people don't like to talk about it. Then people with severe symptoms of the disease are showing up at the emergency room for help, but emergency rooms can't help them. It takes specialized people and programs to care for them and safe places for them to go after they leave the hospital, but there aren't enough of any of these places. So they get sent home with medication, which holds the symptoms at bay for a while, but often they relapse and go back to the emergency rooms, and the emergency rooms can't keep up with all the patients. If this happened suddenly in a small state like Vermont, what would we do? Would there be a swift and unified response? Right now in the state of Vermont, 1 in 20 Vermonters are living with a serious mental illness. Could be a major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. These are not just occasional days of feeling blue. These are more persistent challenges that get in the way of managing everyday life. I'm Erica Heilman, and this is They Are Us, Inside Vermont's Mental Health Care System.
When he went to the hospital the first time and was having the evaluation, the medical evaluation, I was hoping it was a brain tumor. That would kill him, but please don't let it be schizophrenia. Don't let it be that.
Transitioning out of high school, college was eliminated for my son, so he elected to go the vocational route. And he took courses and was on his way to an apprenticeship. He was agitated on his job, and then he would tell us stories that we really couldn't relate to. I'm one of the best apprentice that there ever was. There were questions of, well, what's wrong today? Well, people are sabotaging my work. And I remember having a talk with him. I sat him down to say, you really need to, focus and try. Later, I see him around the house a little too much. And I say to him, what is happening with your job or whatever? The job didn't work out. People sabotaging my work. So he abandoned his job. So at that point, I said, that's it. You're not trying at all. You're not. And he said to me, Dad, I'm doing the best I can. And I said to him, if that's doing the best you can, get out of my house. And I threw him out.
Trying to spend time with him, I would lure him with food and he would generally meet up with me. It's very hard when you can't reason with someone who you used to be able to reason with. And it's hard even to find that person. But as a mother or a parent, you can't not do something.
And a serious mental illness impacts everyone in the family. My oldest daughter, her mind went to, I know this isn't good. My brother has schizophrenia. And I wanna get married. I wanna start a family. We'll always be there as parents. But siblings don't have to be. And no one should hold their feet to the coals. We're in a boat. And we're bailing water as fast as we can. And they're not going to help us in the way that we need. And it's hard.
The last couple times that I've seen him, he's been in a Middlesex residential locked facility. I couldn't see him in his eyes anymore. I couldn't find him. I always, before, when I spoke with him, he was able to make eye contact and you could see, and he would say something that you got a flash of who he was. The last few times I didn't see that. That was devastating. And it caused me to feel hopeless. I had been able to hold out hope. And I'm struggling with that right now.
The hardest part about sitting here with my son right next to me is I don't know what he's feeling. Is there love there? Because you become more robotic. But out of the blue, you know, he'll just say to me, hug me. And, you know, I hug him. And that hug is worth a decade of I love yous.
People having mental health crises are going to hospital emergency rooms in record numbers seeking care.
We're just the catch-all for people. And we can't say no, and we don't say no. We want people to come to us if they're having a psychiatric emergency, 100%. But our doors don't close. They don't close for psychiatric patients, and they don't close for medical patients. And there's times where we can't get out of our own way as far as being able to provide good care for everybody.
That's an emergency room charge nurse in Burlington, Vermont. And she's describing a problem that's playing out not just here, but all over the country. Emergency rooms are not equipped to treat people with mental illness. So ER nurses are tasked with keeping them safe and keeping their other patients safe until a bed opens up in one of the psychiatric hospitals around the state. And those beds are in short supply. Here's the CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat, Lewis Josephson.
If we had people with cardiac conditions sitting in an emergency room untreated, so you just had a heart attack, and you sit in the emergency room for a week untreated till we can find you a cardiac bed in a hospital, people would be up in arms. But you can have bipolar disorder or major depression, have made a serious suicide attempt, and you will sit untreated, having somebody observe you so you don't harm yourself again, sit in an emergency department until you can find an inpatient psychiatric bed. That's acceptable, but it wouldn't be acceptable if it was a more medical condition. So I think that's got to be explained by stigma.
There's a small minority of severely mentally ill Vermonters who struggle for years with recurring psychiatric crises and repeated visits to emergency rooms and psychiatric hospitals. But like regular hospitals, psychiatric hospitals are not meant for long-term care. You're not supposed to check in and stay. So where do people go after they leave? And why do so many people keep coming back? In this show, we hear about the role that housing plays in mental health care. Here's Brian Lincourt, a night charge nurse at the Brattleboro Retreat's Adult Intensive Unit.
We had an elderly gentleman who was terribly ill. He thought he was the Lord God of all creation, and this man was horribly sick. And he came in, and we had him 4 weeks, and eventually got him on medications, and he started to clear. And he would tell us how much better he was feeling. And, I mean, he came in filthy and dirty and naked half the time. And he got on medications, and they helped. He calmed down. He was more comfortable in his own skin. He could sleep at night. He was eating. He looked 10 years younger than when he walked in the door. And we discharged him into the greater community. So after this man had suffered so much and gotten so much better and so many hundreds of hours have been invested, the resources that we had to discharge him into were a hotel room down on Putney Avenue. So 16 hours after we discharged this man, I'm driving into work in the middle of a snowstorm and the man's out there on the side of the road in 20 degree weather making shooting gestures at cars. How am I not going to see this guy again?
Again, here's the CEO of the Brattleboro Retreat, Lewis Josephson.
These are people who are sort of our most challenging people who, again, have a chronic mental illness and have struggled over many years. And so they tend to have periods where they're doing fine and periods where they struggle and we need to be here. And they often stay, you know, they're here for months. What worries me and what frustrates me is the people that stay here for years. And it's not because of their clinical needs. It's because we don't have these residential programs and other programs. And I believe it's really a human rights issue at that point. You have someone, again, imagine you were at a medical center here in Vermont and you were living there for a year, for 2 years, for 3 years, for over 3 years. That's not a place for someone to live their life. You don't You're supposed to live your life in a community of people.
There's enough people like my son who can't live on their own due to their illness. And we are, again, wanting to put them away. They should just go to a hospital. We don't want to see them, as our president said. The sickos. That's what I'm fighting against.
That's Connie Stabler. Her son is 33 years old, and he's been living with schizophrenia since he was 19. In that time, he's been hospitalized 9 times, sometimes for up to a year. He's moved at least 10 times in 13 years. He's lived in temporary therapeutic settings, group homes, and Section 8 housing, which have always ended in crisis and hospitalization.
The ER problem is not just there not being enough hospital beds. I'm not even sure they need more hospital beds in this state. I think they need more permanent housing to keep people out of having to go to the hospital. And it's very difficult to get any level of supportive housing for folks, let alone permanent, because there just isn't enough.
You know, that one person who's on our Tyler 4 state psychiatric unit for over 3 years now, you think about if the average length of stay there is, you know, 6 months, 9 months even, think of all the patients we could have served in that 3-year period. And so that's X number of people less waiting in emergency rooms. And that happens on all of our units, not just the state hospital unit.
Here's the unit chief for adult general units at the Brattleboro Retreat, Carl Jeffries.
We will have patients who very much are just struggling to maintain stability outside of a hospital on their own. They might even have really intensive services where they'll have a case manager from a designated agency who shows up at their house every day and gives them medications and really, you know, a lot of oversight. But the lack of structure of being in an apartment on their own and, you know, having to walk downtown every night, they just aren't able to maintain stability. And everyone comes to an agreement, this person really needs to discharge from a hospital to a longer-term residential program. And they're very limited, and so the wait time can be 2 months.
So my son, you know, is sitting in a hospital because he can't, there's no place for him to go to. And finally, the hospital say, I'm sorry, he can't stay here anymore. And they put him in some temporary place, but he's provided with nothing to do. And he's just going to go out and get into trouble. And at this point, I think they finally discovered that after what I've been telling them for years, that he needs his own room. He cannot share a room. And all of the housing that they have, almost all of it is, you know, you share a room. Now, you put two people with schizophrenia in a room together, and what do you think might happen? And so my son, you know, gets aggressive because when he starts to get paranoid, he starts getting paranoid about what this person is saying about them or doing or might do or is threatening, and he's going to threaten them. And then he's got to leave. He's got to leave.
The Community Mental Health Act of 1963, I believe, was supposed to set up a national system of community mental health centers to care for these people who were coming out of hospitals who didn't need to live their lives there. And they were never funded, ever, as they were intended. And so they were never able to meet the needs. And so we've seen exactly what we've got. We've got people with mental illness living in the streets. We see, you know, what is the biggest mental health institutions in our country? It's our prisons and jails. That's where we're warehousing people, literally. We're not treating them very well. That's where people with chronic mental illness are served. And it's expensive, and they're not getting good care. So, I mean, that's what we've done. We haven't so much deinstitutionalized, taken people out of these big mental health institutions. We've trans-institutionalized them. We've just taken them across the river to the correction system and the prison and jails. And that's where they sit.
What if it were you, or what if it were your family member? You don't think they deserve to live in the community and be a productive member? Because they can and are productive members of our society. They just want respect. They want to live in dignity. And we're not allowing them that opportunity when we lock them up in a hospital. And we're paying to lock them up in that and not have to think about them.
I would love to move upstream. Don't wait till Mrs. Smith is ready to discharge on March 10th. She should be in our database. Oh, Mrs. Smith, she has paranoid schizophrenia. She's been in and out of the hospital 15 times. She did well in this program. She didn't do well in that program. And we should be able to analyze that and stay on top of it. I remember saying to one of the other hospital CEOs recently, they all had tuberculosis. We would be on them like you wouldn't believe it, observing them taking their medication, making sure they're getting their treatment. We would try to control the factors that cause people to be in crisis. We should know these people. There are people.
I want to climb in to what psychosis is like,
right.
I can't get there, and so I can't quite believe it.
Right.
So what do you say? What do you say to the listeners who are trying to understand?
I would say try harder to understand. I would say try harder to understand, be more patient, respond to me. If I'm like in what we call an altered state, respond to me in a calm and caring way, as opposed to a mean, hostile, what's wrong with you kind of way, which is often how people respond to us. They're afraid of us. They don't understand it. We can be kind of scary, I suppose, and unpleasant when we're in those episodes. It freaks everybody out. But you think of me as a person experiencing psychosis or in a psychotic state is scary? How do you think it is for me? One thing I really remember from my first hospitalization was back in the day where you could smoke cigarettes on psych units. But to do that, you had to go into this little room. Those were like the best moments. Those were the moments where we could just be us, and we were comfortable, and we were smoking, and we were looking out for each other, and we were sharing cigarettes. And it was just so comforting and so genuine. And I describe it as like finally finding water that I could swim in.
Of course it's the smoking room.
Of course it's the smoking room.
Do you have memories of a particular conversation that you had in the smoking room that was useful to you?
It's a part of my story I don't really talk about because it tends to upset people, and then maybe it's just something I keep private a lot. But my suicide attempt was a complete failure, but I did some very severe damage to my arms in the process and really should have died. So when I was in the psych unit, I was also being treated medically. So I had, you know, big, huge packing on both arms. I was in IVs. So this was a university hospital, a very wonderful hospital. This real chippy plastic surgeon came in to check on my arms. But he goes to me, he goes, you know, those would heal up a lot faster if you quit smoking. So I didn't say anything because how am I going to say anything? He's a plastic surgeon. I'm the psycho that tried to kill myself. But I'm thinking to myself, how does he not know how bizarre that sounds? And then it just doesn't make any sense. And then contrast that with getting wheeled down in a wheelchair to your buddies in the smoking room who are happy to see you, and they're happy to help me light my cigarettes. That's the unique connection that can happen with people that have these very different but similar experiences. It's just so special and so important when you are around people that you know are feeling discomfort in a way that's more likely than not to be similar to your own. And outside that smoking room with the medical professionals and the psychiatric professionals, I feel nothing but shame. We get so far removed from the idea that we deserve comfort and kindness, and get so used to this idea that we're the problem and that we need to try harder to hurt less. So I think when we're with each other, we can recognize and honor each other in a way that's not romanticizing the lives we've led, but that's just sort of like, I know you know, I know you know. And we can't get that anywhere else. We can't get that from our doctors. We can't get that from books. We can't get that from school. We can't get that from our families, our marriages, our pets. There's no other place we can get that other than being around peers, people that have had experiences. Even if we don't know exactly what your experience is, what this person's experience is, there's this unfortunate dullness in the eyes where the light is trying to come out, but it can't quite get out, that we can see in each other. We know what that look is. People talk about how those of us with mental illness we lack insight into our illness. This will often be written on our medical charts, which become very thick and very interesting with everybody's thoughts. You know what? I never lacked insight to my illness. I had plenty of insight about how ill I was. But I didn't know I could be better. And by better, I mean like well, happy, content, serene. What I lacked insight to was that I could be well.
Alexis was diagnosed with schizophrenia from a young age, and she spent much of her youth in institutions. She started work through supported employment while she was living in a group home in Johnson, Vermont. Here's Alexis.
You're separated from others, which is what schizophrenia does. It's an alienation. It's a feeling that you are living, but you can't have a life. You believe that you are unpalatable, that you are not worthy of happiness. You watch other people live and think, I'll never do that. So what would help is employment. Like Von Trapp, we worked at Trapp Family Lodge for 5 years. Doing housekeeping, and that was team that was through Voc Rehab. And my medication was monitored at first till finally I proved myself. And people who need people.
So what was that employment situation? What did that do for you?
Wonderful.
Why? Why was that?
I had money in my pocket. Thank you. Poverty is a big problem for all of us. And having the dignity of work, the dignity of having enough money to be able to have what you want rather than just be on the dole.
When you're working with people with a mental illness, where have they been? Where are they coming from? What have their lives been until now? Who are these people?
This is as varied as you can look at any community. It can be somebody who has never worked in their life, who spent most of their time as a youth or as a young adult in the state hospital, perhaps, or in some, you know, other facility because they just had troubles from so long ago and never really got out of the cycle that they're in. And then there's folks who were doctors, teachers, nurses, and lawyers, that something happened to them clinically, medically, that changed their life, and they ended up really having a hard time. So it's the same profile, I think, that you'd see in any community. It's just folks that have had difficulty.
Well, how does it look now?
Good.
Want me to do another one of these?
This is Steve. Steve started to develop symptoms of schizophrenia in his early 30s. He was hearing voices. He was homeless for 2 years. Then he started working with a team at Washington County Mental Health. He got medicated, and he started working with the Green Mountain Workforce. We're just using Steve's first name. Can you talk about before work and after work in terms of how that affects your mood and your state of mind?
You didn't feel like doing nothing before work.
you feel like you're the only one with breakdown. You're the only one getting paranoid and all that. And you get low steam or whatever it's called. But once I started work, I felt really good about it. And anyways, I was not as paranoid as I normally was.
Why do you think that is?
Because you keep busy. Yep.
And that busyness, what does that busyness do?
It keeps your mind occupied. And your body makes you feel really good. I got an apartment. I can turn the temperatures up or down. And it's, what is it, 2-bedroom apartment. Plus, it's a lot better making money. Yeah.
You know, the best analogy I can think of in terms of what we do reminds me of curling. You know, when you think about curling, the rock would be the client, okay? The thing that's moving across the ice. And somebody gave it a little bit of a push to help, but the rock's got to keep sliding. And those guys who use those little brooms in front of the ice to sort of keep the ice in a position where that rock can keep sliding, I see us as sort of those people, the people who are doing the brushing.
I'm working for the senior center now. Yep. I'm learning culinary arts. I'm learning how to do the bacon. Plus, vegetables, I'm doing those. I'm doing a real good job, too.
The folks that we try to help find employment in the community actually have a lot to contribute to the businesses that they would work for. That it's not a charity event. And it's not something that after you've gone through everything and you're better will get you a job. This is about looking at employment as one of the ways to get better. Because it gives you purpose, it gives you focus, it makes you feel like part of the community. It doesn't matter what other people think even, because we have all kinds of people who judge us in all kinds of ways. But if you can say, hey, I go to work, I pay my bills, it gives a person that ability to feel that for themselves, not to feel just a victim of their illness. And they don't have to keep proving to people that they're well before they get this little cherry that somebody says is a job.
Has this work changed the way that you feel in the community that you live in the town, in the people who live around you?
Everywhere I go, they say hi, Steve, to me, even on buses and everything. The old people, and I don't remember half their names, but they says, well, I'm from the senior center, you know, stuff like that. Makes a big difference, you know, helping them out. Makes you feel good, too. And lots of them are real nice to you. I like that. Yeah.
There are people who cannot live in the world as the world is arranged. There are also other people who can, who say, why should we care? And why should we subsidize these people?
Yeah.
Tell me what your reaction to that is.
Fear, because they have a voice. And just hoping that that voice will not be heeded. You spoke about being invisible. Mental illness is not a dangerous thing. We want to be a part of the life of our community. We are ill. But if the community can accept us, we can accept ourselves.
With the help of the state of Vermont, Alexis Kiriak went to school for fine art at Johnson State College. Her paintings are hung at prestigious galleries all around the state. She lives in her own apartment, surrounded by her artwork. Steve is working on his culinary skills, and he plans to look for competitive employment in a restaurant. So now, imagine a world where there's nothing surprising about any of this, where people who need extra supports in the community are getting them, and it's become obvious that good mental health is necessary for good physical health, where the fact of mental illness is no more illicit than a broken leg, where, in fact, we all recognize that we're all eligible for all of it. We all have good days, bad years. And imagine a world where our definition of normal is a little more expansive and a little more interesting. That's a nice place. This is They Are Us. I'm Erica Heilman. Thanks for listening.